Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. Most Americans are familiar with Shakespeare and can even quote some of his works, but this is often where that understanding ends. How and why has Shakespeare become such an important part of our culture, and what does Shakespeare say to the modern world? To consider these questions, I have as my guest today Dr. Anna Schnellman, Professor of English from Lindenwood University, Department of Modern Languages, and Dr. Kathy Vasevich, Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities. Thank you for being here today.
You're welcome.
Nice to be here, Don.
I think one of the easiest things to do is a way to introduce the idea of Shakespeare is what type of categories might they fall into?
Well, the traditional easy categories were basically comedies versus tragedies. Then there were romances. Now you can have even more categories, the transvestite plays, the happy comedies, the sad comedies, however you like. But if you want to go back to the first folio, it'd be comedies, tragedies, and histories.
Yes. So traditionally they've been divided that way. And then there's always The Tempest, which isn't a class by itself. But I like to also consider political plays versus social plays. And that's a division I've used quite frequently in my own course.
So what would you classify as the political plays?
Well, Hamlet's a deeply political play. It was written around the time James I and VI ascended the throne. And one of the questions is, what is a king exactly? Is a king the country? What makes up a king? And we have lines such as, the king is a thing. And we see questions of kingship happen quite often in other history plays like Henry V or Richard III, which is quite frankly propaganda and is very clearly propaganda, but still has the same questions. So the questions come up in a fugue-like fashion in the history plays as to the place of kingship, as well as in tragedies such as Hamlet, and even in The Tempest, what's a powerful person like Prospero.
Yeah, and the history plays are definitely political. And I would agree with Dr. Schnellman. When I teach Shakespeare and I use the history plays, I look at the evolution of kingship, what makes a good king. And by the time we're finished looking at the histories, the students have some sort of idea of what Shakespeare would have formulated to be a good king. And some of his plays seen as political during his lifetime, like Richard II, because there was the deposition scene that got censored and pulled out because Queen Elizabeth did not really want the idea of deposition to be in the minds of her subjects.
And would you say that the question of kingship was actually resolved in Shakespeare, Dr. Vasevich?
That is a great question to use with students if you want to enhance the rigor in your classes, because there is no right or wrong answer necessarily, but there is growth. And I've come up with really fascinating descriptions of a good king for my students that also incorporated the idea of popularity. If a king was not popular, that added to the conception of whether or not he was good or not. Because if he was popular, the people would want to follow what he said. And then you layer onto that, well, is what he said or did necessarily good all the time? So it's really wonderful, fascinating, exciting thing to study, and I'm excited to be talking about it now.
Can those be translated into talking about the modern presidency?
Absolutely, although for myself, I keep modern politics out of my classroom. I think what I say is clear and that it could be applied to modern life, but I am very hesitant to make direct comparisons. I like the students to make the comparisons all on their little own.
Yeah, but what you could do is when you look at Richard III, for example, look at the Tudor propaganda machine and what they wanted to do to legitimize the Tudors on the throne. They had to make Richard III look like a villain, and the students can draw their own conclusions as to things they see happening in the world today. But the Tudors were an incredible machine, really understood marketing well. And if you ever go to Hampton Court and you start walking through, eventually getting to the room where you would meet the king, that room is small. But you've come through these huge rooms that slowly get smaller. But what does that do to Henry VIII? It makes him an even more imposing figure,
right?
Because of the contrast in size, because all of a sudden this man fills up the room. And that's what he wanted to be seen as in terms of the most important person and king.
Right. And following up on that, to some degree, marketing is what makes mm-hmm. a monarch. And that's certainly true for our culture, our times. The endless ads, both attack ads and puppy dog ads and what have you. And that really draws into question, again, it cannot be answered, mm-hmm. but you take somebody like Henry V, he was described by his contemporaries as bloodthirsty, ruthless, cruel, and yet he's often portrayed as the perfect Christian king. So that was done for a reason as well, to justify the Tudor reign and to further its, what would you call it, propaganda machine, I guess.
Yeah, because Henry VIII wanted to be descended from the greatest king, the king who ruled over England and France, and that right. was Henry V, even though the lineage was questionable.
With Henry IV, you mean?
In ways. So, yeah. You know, to get from the stable boy to the Tudors to being on the throne. But yeah, when you look at Henry V, you look at Kenneth Branagh's production of Henry V, magnificent movie, incredibly inspiring, heroic music, but there's a lot of bloodshed.
Well, and the thing about that movie, which I very much enjoy, is the most bloodthirsty speeches are seen as glorious. When, for instance, Henry is threatening Harfleur, he manages to evade responsibility. Hey, you know, I could only hold my soldiers back so far. So you better give up now before I lose control. He's never giving the orders. He's not doing anything wrong. The murdering of the French prisoners is not even in the play. Well, it is, but it's kind of glossed over. Mm-hmm. And the only reason is that the boys were killed. And that's not really what happened historically. So the movie very much presents Henry as a blonde, Christian, wonderful king, but the textual evidence suggests otherwise, so it really is a personal choice as to who's producing it, how he's portrayed.
You're mentioning Kenneth Branagh, and I find interesting one of the comments that gets made about the one Marvel movie that I know that he actually directed, which is the first Thor movie, that's very Shakespearean. And I don't know if either of you have seen the film, but I have to admit that was my response also, is that the movie just seemed like it had a Shakespearean feel to it.
Or what people think is a Shakespearean feel. And I think Kenneth Branagh capitalizes on that as well. I saw him as a very young man in England, and he did not have the lead in those plays. But when I taught Shakespeare, the students were very much into the Kenneth Branagh version of Shakespeare versus Tom Hiddleston's Henry IV, Henry V, playing Hal in those movies in The Hollow Crown. Very, very different. But Kenneth Branagh, like Olivier before him, knew what his idea of Shakespeare was, and that's the Shakespeare that he brought out on the screen.
And to his credit, he did popularize Shakespeare. I think that you're right. He had his vision, and I don't know the man, obviously, or how those things work, but there didn't seem to be much room for dissent.
Right. But I will compliment Kenneth Branagh in Much Ado About Nothing in the comedies, because I think he cast a very strong woman in Emma Thompson to be Beatrice. And that's one thing I will say for Shakespeare. If you look at the other dramatists of the time, Shakespeare is unique in that he has very strong women who win arguments, who are witty, who are powerful, unlike his contemporaries. And I think his genius as a writer and capturing real human interactions suggests how he could depart from the culture of the time and have people pay money for him to be a successful playwright and see the plays over and over again with that depiction of a female character.
And if I could piggyback on that, one of the first plays I like to teach is Taming of the Shrew. And of course, that's a play about a woman who's a shrew, who's been tamed, and then she loves her husband and everything is great. And on first reading, the students are thinking, what? This is bad. He starves her. He gaslights her. He psychologically abuses her. I said, yes, all that is true. But considering the play itself, who's got the longest speech at the end? Who's got the power over the others? And frankly, the gaslighting and the starvation and all the rest was very mild considering what was allowed in Shakespeare's day and even encouraged. And then you have the fascinating induction, which goes away.
Right. And then there's the question, too, of who is gaslighting whom?
Right.
Because this is a fantasy put on for a drunk, Christopher Sly. That's the induction. Is this all supposed to be some wildly fantastical play where everything gets questioned? And you're right. The induction goes away because are you left to figure something out for yourself without Christopher Sly? I mean, there's all kinds of historical questions about
it's weird to have a framing device that isn't framed.
Or was something lost? Was something cut? Did Shakespeare go back and revise his plays? Some people think that. So,
but at the end, we're left with the voice of Kate.
Yep.
That's very interesting, especially with the choice you've made that that particular play also has gone over into popular culture in other formats.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be interested in your opinion of how it has actually played out in some of those other formats.
Well, I think for my generation with Elizabeth Taylor, she always wins.
Yes.
Richard Burton takes a back seat no matter what. So I think that goes along the lines of this shrew. And is she a shrew? She is not favored by her father, who treats her poorly. Her sister treats her poorly. Is she only defending herself against her sister? But if we talk about the production, Elizabeth Taylor definitely commands the screen. And I think that that character commands the stage as well. I did see an all-female version of The Taming of the Shrew that cast Kate as a victim of domestic abuse. And this is at the Globe in London. The audience responded with silence at the end because they were so confused. And it was an interpretation that I think you could go to. But having Kate at the end of this production on the ground, on the Globe Theater floor, being beat was very confusing. I think go with Shakespeare's versions of the plays because it's still open for lots of interpretations. Adding actions that are not in the plays, I think, is not necessary. And I think it's misleading. I mean, he has lasted since the early 1600s because of how he dealt with subject matter straight on. He dealt with gender roles. He dealt with a lot of complexities. Let's go with what he's trying to present, be true to the original script, and go from there.
Agreed. And I would say having Kate, I didn't see it, of course, beaten at the end, it simply doesn't make sense because in no other place in the play is she physically beaten or struck. And in many ways, she sees her voice, and as far as who's gaslighting who, she seems to know what she's doing. You know, whatever, I'll say whatever you want. Let's just go on our journey. And then sometimes when people do change things or reinvent Shakespeare, this is a different topic.
Right.
But it really concerned me with the modern Romeo and Juliet when Juliet commits suicide by or dies by suicide via gun. I mean, the whole dagger, this is thy sheath, that makes sense in the context of the play. So I can understand wanting to make the language maybe a little bit more accessible, but I would agree with Dr. Vasevich that the plays are marvels of unity in and of themselves.
Yeah, now people can have their own rendering or reinterpretation or whatever, but don't call it Shakespeare.
Yeah, the Lion King is not Hamlet.
Right.
Did Shakespeare create plays that an internal beauty and an internal consistency, but still open enough that that's the reason why they have survived 400 years now?
And that's why Shakespeare survived.
But that ultimately it's this ability to say, yes, you can run this play, but with mild interpretational differences, you can give slightly different feelings and each generation can look at that and go, yeah, that play still rings true to me.
Right. Because in the centuries after Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet, some people decided it was too sad, so Juliet would live. Well, then it's not a tragedy. So
everybody has to die.
Yes.
That's the rule.
The more deaths on the stage, the more tragic, per Shakespeare.
Yeah, sounds like German heroic tales.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit earlier in the political plays about how propaganda plays a role. Does Shakespeare himself kind of address this idea of propaganda by kings in order to maintain power, popularity, authority?
I think he addresses it in order to maintain his life because he had a really tough job in presenting his art, although he was blessed in having backers and sponsors, one could not irritate or go directly against a ruler. And the fact that he managed to directly question without directly questioning is in itself highly remarkable, that he had the confidence and the skill to do that, because he could have easily been convicted of treason.
Or of being a Catholic.
Or of being a Catholic, yes.
But like the deposition scene I referred back to, Richard II again, the fact that he wrote it in the first place meant that he was very aware of politics. He was being true to history, but the fact that he also put the play on after it was censored and it was still a popular play, he bowed to the political pressures, and we have the original version today we can look to, but he was not a dumb man.
And even that line in Henry V, "Oh God, think not today," mm-hmm. about my father and Richard, that was very brave.
Mm-hmm. If you were going to introduce someone to Shakespeare through his histories, which play would you recommend?
Well, if you're going to ask this question about every genre, I'm going to give you one answer, and we'll let Dr. Schnellman agree or disagree with me. I start with Romeo and Juliet from the tragedies. It's an early tragedy. The language is simple. Students need practice in reading, understanding Shakespeare. When I teach the class, typically students will say, "Gosh, how come Romeo and Juliet was so difficult, but Midsummer Night's Dream was so easy?" As you had practice. Now, Midsummer Night's Dream is the earliest comedy that I teach. It's written about the same time as Romeo and Juliet, as Richard II is written about the same time as well. So I tend to teach Shakespeare's plays chronologically so that the students see his progression as an artist, see what his interests in the subjects were. And I think that makes great discussion, great thinking for the students to see, well, how does Juliet relate to Hermia? Okay, well, they're both tough. They're both really witty. Okay, so how about Romeo and Lysander? They can see the connections. How about Romeo and Richard II? Wow, that might be an interesting pair. And that's how I get them into the play. So teaching the class, that's what I recommend.
I'm going to steal that idea with Romeo and Juliet and the comedy. It really depends on the audience, on mm-hmm. who wants to read it. My father is in his late 80s right now, and he really wants to read some great literature he's either forgotten about or has never read. And he asked me recently, what should I read? I want to read some Shakespeare. And he's a man who is intrigued by power plays. So I suggested to him The Tempest. For instance, in The Tempest, Prospero seems to be looking for excuses to torture Caliban and to punish him. Because if Caliban truly could not help himself, then he shouldn't be punished. And if he could help himself, then he should be taught. So that's intriguing. If I were going to answer that question, I'd have to ask the person, what do you want? What are you in the mood for today? As far as classes, teaching the course, we cannot reasonably expect to our students to read and understand a play per week, which used to be the way it's done. So now I stick to 9 in a 14-week semester. And before the term starts, I give them a menu. Tragedy, we are going to do this or this, which do you want? And they've been clamoring for Macbeth. The other thing that they've been clamoring for that I plan to prepare for next term, because I've never taught it and I haven't read it for a very long time, is Troilus and Cressida. That seems to be something they really want to read, and I want to read it to find out what's drawing them to that particular play.
Yeah, that's very interesting that they would even think of that one.
Clamoring for it.
Wow.
Well, I have to admit, my introduction to Shakespeare came through Henry V and Julius Caesar, but mm-hmm. considering what I do, maybe that's not such a big surprise. So just interesting, what would be your personal favorites among the plays?
Wow. My personal favorite is Midsummer Night's Dream. I really don't recommend students to start off with comedies because they're so allusive, as well as the history plays. I mean, Shakespeare literally in some plays has a history book open as he's writing his plays. The tragedies are much more accessible, but my personal favorite, if you ask me today, it has to be Midsummer Night's Dream, because it is just hilariously funny. The female characters are powerful and good. There is real true love, which is one of the themes I deal with in my classes when I teach it at the end with Hermia and Lysander. And there are other versions of love. So there's one example of really true love. There's one bewitching that's still going on at the end of the play. And then there's this power play between Theseus and Hippolyta. But it's a riot. And it's a very self-conscious play because Puck at the end asks the audience for applause. So breaking the third wall, like you see in all the Marvel movies today. So Shakespeare did it way back.
Dr. Schnellen?
That is a very difficult question to answer because I would have to say, just as my puppy's favorite treat is everything, my favorite play is everything. Just depends on what I'm studying at the time. I would say that the ones I teach are the ones to which I am most drawn. From college onwards, I was drawn to Henry V because it still intrigues me. Who are you? Are you this perfect little goody-goody, or are you a ruthless little son of a gun, or you're something in between? Or what's going on exactly here? What do you want? So I keep on opening the book and trying to figure out who he is. As a play, it's less overtly complex and less of a dance and more of a propaganda, but there's enough in it that keeps me searching. As far as the comedies, I really like Midsummer Night's Dream. I also really like Taming of the Shrew, simply because, again, you have that balance. The subordinate becomes the dominant, and I like to see how that works out. But I just want to kiss Lear on the top of his little old head and smack him at the same time, because I could see how he would fall into that trap of wanting to have the trappings of kingship without the responsibility. But as Shakespeare reminds us, you can't do it that way. Othello is another favorite because he others himself. He's full of internalized racism. He tries too hard to be part of the dominant group, and in so doing, he becomes the worst stereotype of the non-dominant group. So psychologically, I just want to dive into this mysterious tome. And I have never been able to figure out these plays. If a student says, well, what's the main point? I say, there is none. It's magic.
Yeah. Like with Othello, what's a real tragedy? Oh, well, Iago got passed over and so he makes Othello jealous. Yeah, what's a real tragedy? And I think that Othello's view of himself is a tragedy, what others have made him believe for no good reason.
And that he's made himself believe in many ways.
Yeah.
This leads me to think about how Shakespeare is reflected in modern popular culture.
I don't know if either of you were a fan of The West Wing, but there's this wonderful scene where the president is about to fire the Surgeon General, and one of his daughters had actually intervened to make a comment about that. And as he's thinking about really whether or not he should do it, he's walking to a door, turns around and says, oh my, Lear is a good play. And the thing is, you have to actually understand Lear in order to understand why that reference is A, good, and B, why it's funny. And I think a lot of Shakespeare has really seeped into our culture where people don't even realize they're hearing Shakespeare or that the references are to Shakespeare, but they know it.
Mm-hmm. I did have one student ask why Shakespeare used so many cliches.
Yeah, and I like Star Trek movies because they're so Shakespearean.
Yes.
The Undiscovered Country is incredible.
And we see that it pops up rather regularly that Shakespeare does appear to have really been integrated so much into our culture that oftentimes we miss where his influence is. Are there places in particular that in classes you might point out to students and say, hey, you know, what you're watching here or listening to here or seeing here is Shakespearean?
Yeah, I would say that in my survey courses, if it comes up, I might point them to that. And what I try to do is allow my students to love Shakespeare. I find that if they're allowed to, in their words, nerd out over Shakespeare, they can. And they buy the little Shakespeare band-aids and they insult each other in Shakespearean terms. And they start seeing for themselves the incredible influence that Shakespeare has had on our culture, perhaps equal to the influence Homer had on the Greek culture. That's a stretch, but I think that most people have heard of Shakespeare. Most people know the stories. Most people are afraid of Shakespeare, and that's a shame because it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah. Something I'm always fascinated by, so this is just kind of a personal nerd moment on Shakespeare.
Okay.
But I never get a chance to ask experts this particular question. So what is it about The Tempest? It's one of my favorite plays. But Dr. Schnellen, you mentioned it didn't quite fit really any of the categories. Why doesn't it?
Well, because it's neither fish nor fowl nor good red herring. It's not a tragedy. It's not a comedy. It's not a romance. There are critics, including Bernard Paris, I think, who believes that it's Shakespeare's own farewell to the theater. that Shakespeare, too, is breaking his staff, putting away his magic, having gotten what he wanted out of it. And it's interesting because if one reads the play carefully, Prospero is definitely a controlling narcissist. So it's interesting to me, The Tempest, that again, so much psychology can be applied to it. And the storm that wasn't really a storm, and it's reported, Prospero says, it's okay, no harm done. Ooh, that makes me so mad I could just spit. Because that horse is playing with our minds. Psychological harm is just as bad, if not worse, than physical harm. So there's so much that can be seen, and it's so different from the rest of the Shakespearean canon. But I'd be very eager to hear what Dr. Vasevich says.
I think it defies categories. It's been called his swan song. There are some things he retains true to his vision of life. Miranda gets a choice in terms of liking and loving her future husband. The bad guys get punished, as they should. It's very clear why they're being punished in the play. But there are the topical, important pieces of the play, because this was written after the New World discoveries, and you have what's being done to the indigenous people.
The whole question of Caliban.
Caliban. And I think that reading The Tempest today with that lens opens it up in a more fascinating way. Shakespeare was very, very aware of his time. He was very aware of what would be good source material, what was a story that needed to be told, what needed to be addressed. And people paid him for doing that. He made a living. He was not shunned. He was a good playwright, an excellent one.
Maybe a finishing note is a question that I've got to ask, only because it's one of those things in popular culture that keeps popping up. Is Shakespeare Shakespeare?
Yes.
Every person is a construct. Every person has a persona. Every person has a mask. We know that Shakespeare collaborated with others on some of his plays, to the point that Marlowe is now listed as a co-author on at least a couple of them. We also know that The Tempest is Shakespeare's only truly original plot, as far as we know.
Except for the New World documents.
Except for the New World documents, yes. But is Shakespeare Shakespeare? Yes, just as much as Homer is Homer. Shakespeare is our Shakespeare. And just as we don't know, was Henry V really Henry V? We don't know if Shakespeare was Shakespeare, but we still have the living work, and the living work is Shakespeare.
And not Bacon.
Well, thank you.
Bacon.
Thank you so much for being here, both of you, Dr. Vasevich, Dr. Schnellman. I really appreciate your time.
It was our pleasure.
Enjoyed it very much.
And we'll be back soon.
You can download the Thinking Aloud podcast at the Lindenwood University Digital Commons site, digitalcommons.lindenwood.edu/thinking_aloud/.